Thank you all for coming, or not leaving. As Nathan said, my name is Abel, and I do a PhD on Tibetan verbs. This is not less technical than what went before, because it's also very technical. It's a kind of hard way to start, because the PhD is large, and sort of in the middle of it, and there's so many things I might tell, sort of, at this moment, sort of in my development, not sort of really in a position to give, like, sort of the definitive overview of what is going on in Tibetan verb, right? But there are things going on, as you know, if you have studied a bit of Tibetan, the verb is basically, as the sutras explained about the Dharma, you cannot teach it, and it's not intelligible to normal human perception, right? And my job is to make a little more sense of it. And that might seem quite simple, because at a certain point, if you read a lot of Tibetan, you just sort of get used to it. What that means is not clear, right? But if you sort of read a lot of Tibetan at a certain point, you say, well, this is that kind of verb, or it looks like that. But to see, to sort of find out why it works the way it does, is not simple. Usually I have huge presentations and not enough time, and I've tried to overcompensate now, and so I have plenty of time to talk. Feel free to interrupt me. I'm going to start very basic, yeah? You have in the Tibetan verb a possibility to distinguish four different stems: a present, a past, a future, and I call it an optative. And the reason I call it optative and not imperative, as some of you may find more familiar, is that you can also express the negative possibility. That is to say, someone cannot do it. You use mi, bios, and forms like that. And they do not mean don't do it. They mean you cannot do it. That is similar to a potential use of the optative in certain other languages. So that's why I avoid the term imperative. Moreover, if they want to be polite in Tibetan, they don't avoid the optative, which is what you would do if it were imperative. Right? Instead, you use an honorific form, right? But there's no reason, it's not sort of imposing to say, do that with that kind of form, right? So this is terminology. Then there is a long-standing unclarity about the nature of these categories, whether it's aspect or tense, because the three categories, they could be the Sanskrit categories of Vartamana and what was this again? The Daspa and Maungspa, right? Anagama. So these terms are not necessarily correct, right? But they're nicknames for the categories, and whatever happens, right? For instance, if you have a prohibitive, you say ma biet, don't do it. This is regular in all the texts. So it's not necessarily what the label says, but we need labels, right? So this happens only with verbs that have an agent and that have control, right? So it's not a verb to see, which is tong, and that wouldn't conjugate or inflect. Only the verbs that have an agent that sort of decides or intends to do something will have those four verb stems. And these are actually a rather small minority, and the vast majority have two stems, right? So then you have, I call it a syncretic two-stem paradigm, and the syncretism is primarily in the future and present, they are the same, right? There's no distinct future stem. And from, say, post-canonical period onwards, the future is just lost, like in Milarepa, you have no predictive use of the future. So this is what we see all Tibetan already sometimes, that you can use bien with future reference. Distinction between present and future sort of is morphologically weak, and semantically it's also weak. Then when you come to the intransitive verbs, distinction just doesn't exist. Yes, so there's no sort of possibility actually to distinguish a formal future from a present. So you better call this a non-past. Then the past and the optative also go together, as you probably know, right? So if you would say, let this happen, it's gyurjik, without the apostrophe, which would be sort of like gyur in Old Tibetan. Then you have some suppletive paradigms, which means that the future, or the future present is not related to the optative. So, draw song and om shok. Yes, and here the future present is related to the past, but not to the optative. So here's a non-equal sign. So this is a problem in the sense that this shouldn't be allowed, right? Only the transitive agentive verbs ought to have optative, and here it does happen. Now, historically, we can sort of connect this one to shek, the honorific form for to go. It's already done by Jeschke in his dictionary. And that is plausible. You have an e and an o, and there might be an a in the base, a stem. You have a neat upload, right? But synchronically, so as the language works, this is simply an optative of come, regardless of politeness or not, right? So that doesn't work there. Then there are defective paradigms, and you may have never noticed because you don't see the verb very often, but om in om chik is to give, only in optative. Moreover, if you look where this verb to give is used, it's when you say in Dutch, my native language, give up, which means give to me. And you can use that up with several verbs. It's always towards me as opposed to somewhere else. So now we have two optative forms that are weird, right? And what I'm trying to do in general when I find something weird in Tibetan, and it's not so much about these forms as about the kind of thinking I'm trying to develop, is how do we make sense of things that look odd? In this case, we have two things to explain, and I try to explain them at once. So, I suggest that for these two weird verbs, there's a distinction between towards the speaker and towards someone else. So that's away from the speaker, yeah? In that case, you cannot say come to someone else, that would always be go. Does that make sense? So go would get the optative as usual from the past tense, which it does. Right, we know that. But if you say come, you cannot use the same form. You get another optative set. This is a suppletive optative. And it works the same way with give. So you have bien when you give it away, and on when it's towards the speaker. So you want to get it. In that case, you have explained the gaps. You cannot come away, right? You can only come toward the speaker. And you cannot go towards speaker, that would be to come. Any questions so far? So in this case, I try to relate verbs that are not related etymologically, but make sense of their synchronic relation, but not force them in the same paradigm if they obviously don't belong there. Right? In addition, could explain, and this is speculative because it's prehistory, why we have om and shok here in the first place, is that the verb to give towards the speaker was originally the verb om plus chik that assimilated.
So, what are the columns?
The columns, come, go, give.
Yeah, those are not paradigms.
These are paradigms.
So there are two. There can be two octaves in the US.
Yes, but you have a look. This is flat, but there's a third dimension, which is away or towards, right? So what I try to do is to distinguish the features that relate the verbs and explain the distribution. All right. So you may find this convincing or not, or may want to meditate on it or see in the text where it actually works. But the point is not so much whether this is correct, although I do believe that it's correct, but to show you something about how we can sort of fit weird verbs together in a sensible way, right? In this case, they were already fit together, right? This is the paradigms we know and try to explain them. There's another type of paradigm which I haven't mentioned, and that is this one. It's unique as far as I know. There's another.
I may have missed it, but by optative, you mean imperative?
Yeah, you missed it.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's later. Yeah. Thanks. Because it would have been a very welcome suggestion if I didn't. So the verb above means descend, come down, fall, but also river from a mountain downwards. And that has, for some authors, an optative bob, or bobs even. It depends on the source of the manuscript. Well, again, this is weird, because now it will be the only optative that is sort of directly related to the other forms. And what you see in manuscripts, when the form is used, for instance, in the Zhang Lung, which I will use several times in this talk, you get the old Tibetan manuscript from Dunhuang that says Bob Shik, which is probably the form with the S that got assimilated and then it's lost here and added there. And a later editor in one of the canonical editions says, well, this is not proper for an intransitive verb, and we rather have by dual chip, which is sort of how you make optatives if you don't have them, right? Let it happen that it comes down. In this case, my question is not so much sort of who is right or wrong, but just to sort of observe that sort of Tibetan readers and writers have different opinions on that themselves as well, right? And just the fact that this is later doesn't mean that it's bad, and this is not necessarily better because it's earlier, because some dialects are more conservative than other dialects, and there are extremely ancient forms that can survive till a very recent day, we know from other language families. But the main point is to see that sort of this form was apparently weird for some Tibetans as well, right? So if we cannot explain it because it doesn't fit in here, then at least I can say, well, others were not too happy with it either, right? So this takes us to the problem of variant readings. Do you have all, you all have a hand up by now?
Yeah?
Okay. So I can mention the numbers, right? Number 10. You can have a glance at that. This is a silly story from the Zhang Lung about a Buddha who had a previous reincarnation as a lion, moreover as a vegetarian lion. So he was sort of chewing cud and fortunately, there came a hunter who shot the lion for the skin. And this is what happens when the lion is dying. Heaven and earth quaked, the rain came down without there being clouds. The god saw the lion was killed, and through the heaven above, they sent down a rain of divine flowers. Now, this is completely beginner's level Tibetan. But the rain is pap with an aspirate in the Old Tibetan manuscripts. And canonical editions quite rightly change that to bap, because the rain falls by itself without agent, right? And the gods who sent down the rain of flowers have bap in the manuscript And that should be pop, of course. Yeah. I think it would be uncontroversial for anyone who sort of has seen a bit Tibetan, right? The rain falls by itself. If the gods threw flowers from above, that should be the transitive, right? And it's also uncontroversial, apparently, for some Tibetans themselves, because only a little later in the manuscript, the events are sort of told again, and you get expected forms. So what we know now is that manuscripts can be mistaken. This is hardly any news, but normally you just get over it, right? You make sense of what's going on in context. And if the verb form doesn't cooperate, well, you won't lose any sleep over it, right? But my job is to lose sleep over that, and I do, right? And then you have take every variant serious. At the same time, you cannot take them all equally serious, right? So accidents happen, but I have to evaluate whether whether it's a significant accident or just an accident. Another passage in another story of the Tsang Lung. The Buddha, or actually it's another teacher, I think, I forgot the details, has gathered lots of people for an audience to teach the Dharma, and Ma lets it rain golden coins into the crowd. They fight for the coins, and consequently they don't hear the Dharma, right? These are real shravakas then, right? I mean, there's sort of no sort of sophistication or whatsoever. And this illustrates that. But the Old Tibetan manuscript has but, which is weird because it should be but. But apart from that, it's intransitive, right? And there is a bias at the end, which tells them, like, he does this whole thing. So he makes that the rain falls, and then it's not that someone else drops the rain, right? So then Babs is correct. Whereupon the people fight, and the Dharma could not be heard. Then another editor, later editor, decides, well, is Mara doing it, so it should be Pop, which is sensible enough. But then he adds a causal connection here. The past, which is, you know, nominalized and then instrumental, so you get the sequel happened because of that. And then this is finally changed, and I put it in a footnote because the margin notes are not wide enough. The degradation makes it, the Dharma did not become heard, and it's a totally different construction. So the bias is gone here, right? So this is a conspiracy of several different variants, and here it's actually interesting what they do, right? Because if the editor changes the bias to the cure, then Mara would have nothing to do if this remained intransitive. Yeah, so this has to be transitive, but then his action stopped there, and the rest is just causal sequence. So then you get a whole constellation of variants. And now this is transitivity, however, fairly what that means. Either someone is doing it or not. And it may be that someone is involved and it's still intransitive, but then it was not on purpose. So for instance, if you have read the story of Dandin in Han's primer, then Dandin throws a stone at the horse because he has to stop it. And then the horse breaks a leg and dies, and they go to the king for trial, and the plaintiff says, he killed my horse. And he uses bikun, which is to kill. And then the Dandin says, well, actually, I threw the stone, and then the horse, boom. The horse died. But I didn't kill it, right? So you can use that for responsibility as well. This is still possible in modern Tibetan, by the way. Okay. But we know what transitivity means. We are at page 4. Now, as I just said, I was interested in future stems. Here you have one in sort of in real life. that says that something is not possible. The Dharma could not be heard. Everybody knows the phrase Pakdume for Amitabha. Amitabha use, depending on which noun precedes, right? Immeasurable. This is inaudible. No, this is an ideal hunting ground for future steps. So if you look at table 1 on page 4, you see all the constructions with du, me in Zhanglun, not all of them, the transitive ones. And they're all future steps. This is nice. Like I have a sort of natural way of determining what a future stem was for that author at that time. Yeah, because he does it consistently. Now, then we get manuscript variants. There is one passage where someone says, I cannot help you, and he uses bestang, which is a rare verb. Right? The present is a storm, and you don't see it very often. And the Peking editor decided to make tang. I cannot sell my son. And the Degi editor decided, well, slang is actually better, you cannot get my son. This is all plausible readings. But they agree that it should be future, which is nice because they might as well decide, oh, well, it should be a different tense form or something like that. But decide they agree on the tense form and only change the lexical verb that appears in that tense form. So we know these are all future stems, and then suddenly you get another type of stem where the Old Tibetan manuscript has bisket for generate, or in Sanskrit janayati, so cause to be born, and the classical editions change that into a future present. Now here we have a problem. What is the correct future stem? Because the paradigm in classical, sort of canonical Tibetan, in your dictionaries and in later texts, would always be skyet is both future and present, and with the be is past. And I ignore the optative here for the moment, but it would be without the be. But then there's another type of paradigm, which is also found here. Brijot, which has no be in the present, of course, but has a be both in the past and the future. Yeah? So it's plausible that the author used this verb in that pattern. Yes? So he used the verb skiet in the pattern of Brijot. And then we have a be in the future, and that's what he does. And the classical editions, or canonical editions, later canonical editions, all disagree. But if you look at other canonical texts, I put this in the footnote, it's all the way down, you'll find forms, Utpadi Tafya, which is a gerundive. And if there's any form, any context where you expect a future stem in Tibetan, it's a gerundive, translations of gerundives, especially with Bya and especially with Gur after it. In the Abhidhamma Kosha, they also use bisket with a B. So, this is apparently old. It happens a lot in classical text, in canonical texts. So this paradigm, which would be correct for a biography like Milarepa, Marpa, Tilopa, they would have this paradigm. In Old Tibetan, you would actually have this paradigm also for skip. So in this case, the manuscript variants are significant. This is an actual historical change. Now, I will... Yeah, there's nothing else I have to say about this. Okay. Another type of variation. We are page 5. Again, a simple scene from Zhanglun. This is not my favorite text. It's actually, I find it a tedious text, but it's easy because it gives common ground. Like this, everybody has an idea what the stories are like and what the style is like, right? And if I take a very obscure text, then it will be harder to get my point across. In this case, we have Mara and the Lord again. Mara sees the Lord who has entered Samadhi, so deep meditation, and for distraction or for whatever reason, this actually never becomes clear in the story, Mara leaves a jewel of great value on the Lord's head. I assume that a chupan is a jewel. It's probably a long word from Chinese. Yeah, I don't know what that is. Now, the Lord sort of regains sort of his normal level of consciousness and realized there was this CP, this is the real word, the jewel on his head. And that's the verb retox. And you expect a past form before ne or nas. No. The Lord considered who left it there, Britaksna, which is not a past form, and realized, Britox, that Mara had left it there. Now, if you look at the paradigm of Ritok, number 16a, that's a very neat four-form paradigm. Then apparently, there is a form, Ritox. And this is not a novel discovery of mine. You can find these in dictionaries as well. To realize, which adds an S to the present stem. That makes it a past. So this is not a full paradigm, but it's a derived form. Now, what is nice about this passage, and this is the kind of thing that sort of can make me happy occasionally, is that you have different verb forms in a context that makes it absolutely clear what is going on and that they refer to the same events. So we're not dealing with sort of vaguely similar passages, but the same context and the specific use of a different form of the same verb. In this case, it's clear that realized is different from, say, butax with the a. Active is more like to inspect or consider. I'm not going to enter the range of Sanskrit verbs that sort of can be translated by the tak, but it's quite interesting actually. It's sort of like German anschauen and things like that. It's sort of very both sort of active and perceptive at the same time, right? So. Very much unshowered in the Kantian sense of the word, actually. If you look at other verbs that sort of have similar patterns, we get zin, zoom, gzoom, and zooms, to grasp. Yeah. It's also used as a verb of thought, that it means to comprehend, understand. Right? And it has another alternative past, which is unmistakably derived from the present, which is zin. Oh, I forgot to say the little d is a dead drop, right? In case we didn't sort of. There's a little d, right, in the transcription. Yeah. The apostrophe is removed, then the za becomes a normal za, and you get. Thirdly, this happens with a verb separate, distinguish. Again, this can be used as a verb in sentiendi. There's a regular transitive paradigm, pied, and you can remove the apostrophe and get a past tense that translates Sanskrit bina to be split. But it's also used as a verb sentiendi. It happens in the Old Tibetan Ramayana. Some monkeys see something in the distance and then they manage to discern what it is and they use bien without the apostrophe. This is the exact same context as where in example 15 the Zhanglong has the talks. So there's a pattern there, which is different from intransitive verbs, like 18C, now 18B2, sorry, I changed the number, where you have a verb that is actually transitive, but not quite as transitive as the full form verbs. And it seems to mean something like it happens, which and the agent or whoever is involved noticed, but it was not controlled by the agent. And indeed, with Zin number 17, you can find things like they tried to catch the monkey and it didn't work, and finally Zin. Finally they got it, but it's not that they grabbed it just like that. So what is removed here in the morphology is the prefix, if there was one. And what is removed in semantics is the agentivity. There's no longer a controller in the action. But the role is still there. It's just not something under the agent's control. So if it comes to these kind of derivation that happened repeatedly and are actually used in narrative, as you might expect, not a sort of etymologically related form, but as a form that just does what is required there, then it means that for a history of Tibetan verb, you would have to add a section, but also for the synchronic description of Tibetan, you have to add a chapter. Or a section, like there are verbs that do this. Obviously, if this is combined with manuscript variants, then it gets problematic. Like you try to sort out one thing and meanwhile another thing happens. And it does. For instance, I know Old Tibetan Ramayana, Sita is stolen by a demon from Rama. This is what the whole story is about. And the verb to do that is prok, which is to rob, right? And then the future has two forms. One is with a D prefix, and the other is just no prefix at all. And if that is just an accident in a manuscript, then it happens. But if there is a logic to using unprefixed forms, then I will let you know, because I'm sorting this out. Page 6. I'm always to at the end of the story. It's again future stems, this time from the Abhidhamma Kosha. The forms with met that we saw in Changlung, I also found the Abhidhamma Kosha, of course. They're not very common for gerundives, because usually you have translation with gya or ge or both. But you can get forms like 19. Where there's a Sanskrit gerundive hidden in the compound derivation, namely kartavya, to be done. And puna kartavya is to be done again, and apuna kartavya is not to be done again, and with the ta, it's the quality of that. And that translates as one word as unrepeatability in Tibetan, and that's sort of carefully translated every morpheme, but also change the syntax. For the Pakdu-Meh construction, so to say. Now there's several auxiliaries that work like Meh with the future stem. And I have given a small list in table 2. This is all I could find in the entire Abhidhamma Kosha, so that's not much compared to the large numbers of gerundives in the text. But for Tibetan Bestam, to show, also to teach or demonstrate, I get a nice set with the possibility, the necessity with ye, so that will be the gerundive, if Sanskrit had gerundive there, and the negative. The second set, so this is in the mid of table 2, has just similar forms, but not a nice set of the same verb. And the third set has the gerundives that are usually translated with pya or meh. But it's clear that they match with gerundis, these me and je and rung forms. Finally, there is a weird form, pritja, which is just the imperative. Ask. And here Tibetans are polite enough to translate, I prithee to ask, or I beg you to ask. This is a very common construction in Tibetan, we call it a performative, right? You say that you do it and you do it at the same time. And that has a form, dri, without prefix and without suffix. And that shouldn't be allowed because, as you can see in 21, this is Dzangbun again, you should have a future stem there. I ask you to teach you, to teach us at length. And wherever you look with Searle in that construction, you get future stems. Now, Dri is not supposed to have future stems because it's a two-stem verb paradigm. But as in number 20a, then Dri without prefix does not occur as a normal future, but it occurs almost regularly as a subordinate form, as happens with the translation of Pritja. So in this case, to sort of connect the whole story start to finish, there are four paradigms that seem tidy, and there are variants that seem untidy, and there are forms that seem untidy that are real. And this that happens not only in Old Tibetan, but also in prestigious texts like the Kosha. I am now trying to figure out what the function of the non-past, non-prefixed, so almost completely stripped verb stems mean if they're used in subordinate forms like trio, so. As far as I've been able to figure out now, this is a context where the Old Tibetan Ramayana, for instance, would use the prop form for to rob sita without the prefix. So it looks like they have sort of an extra sort of subjunctive form for this kind of constructions. So then suddenly the paradigms are not as tidy anymore as we have seen at the start, where we had, well, you know the drill, four stems at most, usually two stems, and then two weird verbs. In fact, there's a lot more going on, and it's still going on in early Tibetan. It's not dead yet, and it will die off for most dialects. And it's quite interesting because to put it informally, they mess around. But you can only mess around that way if you still know how it works. Yes? I don't know whether any of you, probably some of you will have children, and if you have heard sort of while they grow up and they struggle with the strong verbs in English, yeah? So things like bring, brought, and the irregular verbs, right? They can be quite creative with that. And in Dutch, in my native language, we have a lot more of those verbs, more like German. And it's quite funny because they have some sort of pattern to it, and they try to apply that pattern every now and then where it may or may not fit, and finally they get used to it, you know, just like we get used to Tibetan. But while it still happens, you can also get forms like English dive, dove, where there is no history for dove. This is just something that some people decide at a certain point. We can use dove like just like we have drive, drove, which is old.
Americans. I think some across the ocean decided
with the dove.
Yeah.
But you can get some things that sort of really work. Like with sneak and I snuck in. That's definitely American, right? But I think it's a quite convincing sort of for the feel of it as well, right? Which is the, snuck is better than sneak.
Snuck.
Yeah. I like that. But this is what Tibetans do still in Old Tibetan, and it's nice to see that happening, and it's very difficult to sort it out. So what I've tried to do now is basically explain how complicated it is, and not what the solution is, because I don't know. But it can be sorted out, and I hope to be able to say within the foreseeable future that I have sorted out. Thank you.